Hello and welcome to Out in the Bay, gay radio from San Francisco. Our lives, our voices. I'm Eric Jansen. This week, helping queer refugees. We've heard about horrific anti-gay violence in Jamaica, the Middle East, and other parts of the world. Just for one example, earlier this year, travel writer Michael Luongo was on Out in the Bay detailing some of the murders, tortures, and other violence against gay people that have intensified in Iraq, especially over the past year since the U.S. troop surge. This half hour, we're going to look at another aspect of anti-gay atrocities around the globe. We'll hear about the plight of those who flee death threats and unimaginable anti-gay horrors in their homelands, often landing in neighboring countries just as homophobic as the ones they've fled, and often with no resources because they've left everything behind. Often they end up stuck and now destitute in situations almost as bad as what they left behind. My guest this week is Neil Grungrass, who founded ORAM, the Organization for Refuge, Asylum, and Migration, based in San Francisco, to help LGBT refugees worldwide. Neil Grungrass, welcome to Out in the Bay.
Thank you, Eric. It's great to be here.
Neil, I know that ORAM's work so far, and first of all, how do you pronounce that, ORAM or ORAM?
Either way.
Is it kind of a Middle Eastern pronunciation to it? Is that the idea?
It's a pronunciation that works anywhere in the world.
Okay, great. I know that ORAM's work so far is concentrated in the Middle East, but before you describe some of the specifics there, could you tell us how many countries in the world is homosexuality a capital offense, punishable by death?
There are seven countries where technically homosexuality is a capital offense. But there are, of course, 85 countries where homosexuality is illegal to one extent or another.
And are there countries that are particularly bad for LGBT people? What are the worst?
I would say the top of the list is Iran right now, and it has been for the last few years, in terms of government persecution. But there are many, many other countries. Iraq, of course, has intermittent horrible violence. The Palestinian Authority is also very bad if you get caught. Jamaica's pretty bad right now.
Mm-hmm. I did see an interview with you on 10% TV in April of this year, and you noted that in the past 20 years, Iran had executed something like 4,000 gay men and lesbians, or is it just gay men or both?
It's gay men and lesbians, and that's just an estimate. There are no official numbers. We don't really know the real reason why people are executed in Iran.
Mm-hmm. And Saudi Arabia had beheaded two men.
That's
officially,
right.
Or were these just sort of mob attack kind of things, or officially condoned?
Officially condoned, yes.
Mm-hmm. Do you have any current figures from other countries?
We don't have figures, and actually this is one of the problems and one of the reasons that ORAM was founded, was that we don't have information. No information has been collected to date on systematic empirical information about persecution of LGBTs. Traditionally, the issue has been treated as an internal cultural problem, an internal political problem or issue that every country has the right to deal with however they want, and no one has actually gone to the effort to count. But also, we haven't had access to these places mm-hmm. to be able to count.
When you say no one has counted, are you talking about the United Nations, for example, or our U.S. government?
The U.S. government has not counted, has no way of counting. The U.N. hasn't counted and hasn't made an effort to count. But you see, one of the difficulties is that most of the executions or most of the severe persecution is taking place at the hands of private individuals or even people's own family members. And many times you're never going to know that someone has been killed because they're gay or lesbian. You'll just you won't know that they've been killed at all. It might have happened in a little village somewhere.
Right. Nobody knows. Nobody hears.
Right.
Mm-hmm. There's a New York Magazine article from October that goes into lengthy detail about the escalation of anti-gay witch hunts in Iraq. I'm going to read just one paragraph. Again, this is from an article by Matt McAllister. As virulent as the violence against gay people, men mostly, was, it operated at a kind of low hum for many years, overshadowed by the country's myriad other problems. But in February of this year, something changed. There was no announcement, no fatwa, no openly declared policy by a cleric or militia leader or politician. But a wave of anti-gay hysteria hit the country. an Iraqi TV station with disapproving commentary, showed a video of a group of perhaps two dozen young men at a private dance party wiggling their hips like female belly dancers. Terms like the third sex and puppies, a newly coined slur, began to appear in hostile news reports. Shia and Sunni clerics started to preach in their Friday sermons about the evils of homosexuality and the people of Lot. Police officers stepped up their harassment of openly gay men. Families and tribes cast out their gay relatives. The bodies of gay men, often mutilated, began turning up on the street. There's no way to verify the number of tortured or harassed, but the best available estimates place that figure in the thousands. Hundreds of men are believed to have been killed. By the way, one of the torture killing methods that mentioned in this New York Magazine article is anal gluing, in which gay men's anuses were glued shut and then the men were force-fed laxative and water until their insides burst. I don't know if that's the most horrific examples that you know of, Neil, but on the bright side, the article also talks about how some of these men are getting out of Iraq, a sort of a modern-day underground railroad, I guess, that takes them to neighboring countries, and if they're lucky, eventually to Europe, North America, or some much safer Western country. I'll just cite this article. It's very informative. It's called The Hunted, New York Magazine, published October 4th, 2009. So now, Neil Grundgrass is with us. You're involved in this work of helping LGBT refugees get to safety. Before you tell us how your organization helps these refugees, a specific question about Iraq. How is the escalation of anti-gay atrocities there related to U.S. presence and involvement?
I can only hypothesize, but the issue of homosexuality is not new to the Middle East, of course. It's been a regular part of life for millennia. What's new is that the kind of gay identity that's coming out in the Middle East, that's developing in the Middle East, is a Western kind of gay identity. And it's very easy for locals to target gays as identified with a Western oppressor or with a Western occupier. So
it's in a sense, it's a part of a hatred of Westerners that is, you know, gay is a Western thing.
Absolutely. It's an encroachment of a Western lifestyle and something that's very unwelcome in most of the Middle East.
Mm-hmm. You're tuned to Out in the Bay on KALW 91.7 FM. I'm Eric Jansen. My guest is Neil Grundgrass, founder of the Organization for Refuge, Asylum, and Migration. We're talking about anti-gay violence in the Middle East and other parts of the globe and the plight of gay, lesbian, and transgender refugees fleeing their homelands. So how does ORAM help refugees fleeing these horrid situations?
We have a three-prong approach. We conduct education, advocacy, and direct representation. Of course, we can really only get to the tip of the iceberg of this enormous problem. But we need to operate on all three fronts because there has been so little done at all for LGBT refugees worldwide. What we're doing is attempting to educate the population, first of all, teaching people what a refugee is and what a refugee is in an LGBT context, advocating to get real change, and that is get real change internationally in the organization that actually that has authority over most of the refugees in the world, which is the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees in Geneva. And we're also doing representation in conjunction with a partner organization in one country right now, which is Turkey.
Okay, and Turkey. I do want to definitely ask you about the specifics of the Turkey, what you're doing in Turkey. You mentioned sort of raising awareness about what it means to be a refugee in an LGBT context. Mm-hmm. What do you mean by that?
Most of us by now have read or heard about LGBTs who have applied for asylum. There have been a few articles, in fact, in the last few days about perhaps a number of LGBT asylum applicants rising in the West. But what most people don't know is that this is the tiniest percentage of LGBT refugees who actually get to the West.
Mm-hmm.
Because most of the LGBTs that are running away from home could never get a visa to the United States or Canada or the UK for the very same reason that they're being persecuted. In other words, what's happened is that they've been marginalized at home. They have no access to jobs or to money or to real estate or to any of the things that you need to do to walk up to a window at a U.S. embassy and apply for a visa to come to visit the U.S. So if your life is in danger, what you do in that situation is you cross a land border. You run away. You get out as soon as you can. With a shirt on your back, or not even.
And so no papers, no possessions, none of the resources you might need.
Exactly. And none of the family you might need to survive when you get to your country of first asylum. If you've been persecuted in your home country, or if you've been so marginalized, you probably don't even have the job skills to survive there. And you don't have the language skills, and on and on and on. So what I'm trying to get across is that, unfortunately, the people that we see here in the U.S. applying for asylum are the upper class, if you will, of refugees.
Sure, sure. So how did you've been working in refugee law for something like 2 decades, right?
A bit more.
Okay. So what prompted you to found ORAM? What was the need that you saw? And, you know, you said before we went on the air that you're working in Palestine previously, right? Or in Israel?
In Israel.
With Palestinian refugees.
That's right. Well, I started to come in contact with the issue many, many years ago here in San Francisco when I was practicing immigration law, refugee law, private practice. And I had several gay clients. At that time, some were coming from Brazil, some were coming from other places in Latin America. And I didn't, at the time, I didn't realize how huge a problem it was. I was very happy to be doing that kind of work, as depressing as it was, but I didn't understand the magnitude of the international problem until much later. Several years later, I went on to direct a U.S. Government Center for Processing Refugees in Vienna, and I looked at the refugees who were coming from Iran and wondered, well, how many of these people are gay, and why am I not seeing LGBT refugees? I fast forward a little bit to my work in Israel, where I helped to co-establish a refugee clinic. It was the first one in Israel. And there we got some Palestinians.
The first refugee clinic at all?
The first refugee clinic at all in Israel. It was established at a university there. We got some Palestinians who were coming in and telling us the most horrendous stories about things that they had escaped from and the Palestinian Authority, either in Gaza or the West Bank, and had come into Israel. Now, for a Palestinian to come into Israel and live illegally in Israel is no piece of cake.
Right.
So
you got to be escaping something pretty severe.
Absolutely. And at first, I got to tell you the truth, I thought that they couldn't really be telling me what had happened to them. It must have been made up.
Mm-hmm. So because they were so fantastic. Can you give us any examples or...
Yeah. What emerged was a pattern, and the story pretty much repeated between refugee and refugee. People told that in their teenage years, they would have come in, they were sought out, or they were caught somehow by the police, that the police then tortured them, arrested them, tortured them, sometimes raped them, sometimes didn't. And forced them to give out the names of everybody else that they knew who was gay. They were given the option of becoming a collaborator, and that meant informing on anybody else who was having gay relations, or being jailed, or being tortured. They were given one warning and then released, given time to think about whether they wanted to work with the police or whether they wanted to spend more time in jail.
Mm-hmm.
Most of them at first denied it, were released, came back again. The beatings got harsher and harsher. By the third time, people were getting locked in solitary confinement with rodents and insects all climbing all over their bodies for days on end, immersed in sewage water, made to stand on one leg, being burned with cigarettes, being beaten. And then there were the other stories. There was a story that still haunts me about a room with three men who were all suspected of homosexuality or abetting homosexuality. There's a story about one who was about 15 years old who was forced to sit on a broken Coke bottle.
Mm.
And the refugee that had come into our office was describing how blood was gushing from his rectum and how the police officers around him just laughed at what was happening. At first, I thought this couldn't possibly be true. because it's happening a few miles from where I'm having my cappuccino. It's not humanly possible that such brutality could exist. And yet more and more people came in and told the same story. And I started to understand that what was happening is, as in other parts of the world, homosexuality is often coupled with a very convenient scapegoating. In the context of Israel and Palestine, because Palestinian gays tend to run away into Green Line Israel, mm-hmm. because it's safer there, they are then blamed for being collaborators and for collaborating with the Israelis. And then a vicious circle forms, where someone is assumed to be a collaborator, they run away somewhere where they may actually become a collaborator.
Right.
And at that point, everyone who's gay is assumed to be a political enemy and a collaborator.
So the politics and the sexuality get all mixed together.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. So how long ago was this that you were doing this work in Israel, and how did it lead to the formation of Oram?
It was 5 or 6 years ago that I started to work with Palestinians in Israel. And even back then, I had no idea, no inkling of what the problem was. And, you know, I got to tell you that and now looking back, I think I was pretty dumb, having worked in the field for 20-something years and not understood that what I was looking at was an invisible sea of refugees. Now, when I think about the issue, I think, my God, 85 countries criminalize homosexuality. 7 countries apply the death penalty. Where do you think these people go? Do you think they really stay home and get killed? Do you think they allow themselves to be beaten to death? No, they run away. But what they do is they run away and they don't tell anybody that they're LGBT.
Right.
And then we fast forward to my work in Turkey a few years ago, or started to see some of these people.
And what brought you to Turkey?
I was working in the whole Middle East, and Turkey was one of the places where I was doing reconnaissance, where I was doing refugee work, or observing the refugees that were coming through. At the time, we were assisting many groups of refugees. There were women, there were LGBTs, there were unaccompanied children. It was through Amnesty International's work in Eastern Turkey. And I started to notice many men who were effeminate, whose claims had been denied, claims for refugee status. They had been interviewed, they told some kind of cockamamie story about why they were applying for refugee status, and they were denied. And slowly I started to understand that there were many, many, many gays all around me. Most of them were from Afghanistan and Iran. And they had made up claims because they felt unsafe, even in the country that they had escaped to. Mm-hmm. They had felt unsafe to tell anybody the real reason.
And how is Turkish laws about homosexuality?
Turkish law does not prohibit homosexuality. Most of the persecution that goes on in Turkey is private. Some of it goes on at the hands of the police. But Turkish society is very conservative. And outside of the major population centers of Istanbul and Ankara, Izmir, mm-hmm. Being gay is frowned upon at best, to prohibited at worst.
Right. So it's not outlawed by the government, but it is culturally it's not condoned for the most part.
Culturally, it's not only not condoned, it's condemned.
Right.
And very often, the police don't interfere or don't intervene when a gay person is bashed or when a transsexual is murdered. And there have been at least 10 murders of transsexuals and transgendered people in Turkey this year, and there has been no investigation. So you pretty much know that if you're gay or lesbian or transgendered in Turkey, if you're beaten up, you're not going to be helped.
Mm-hmm. So that presents the problem then. So someone comes into the country from Iran or Afghanistan and is being gay and escaping anti-gay harassment or violence or threats of death, is that a legitimate reason for asylum in the eyes of the Turkish government? I mean, is that what they should be saying on their asylum applications?
Well, that's what they have to be saying, because that's the truth. And one of the problems, and I'll answer your question in a second, the problem we were seeing, as I was saying before, is that they were not saying that because they were so afraid. They were making up stories and then being denied.
Because they'd lied.
Mm-hmm. Right. Because their stories didn't hold together.
Right.
as they should have been denied, because the authorities need to have a claim basis to approve a claim. Now, Turkey actually is in a very unusual situation as regards the law. Turkey actually has signed the Refugee Convention, but only as to European refugees. And what that means is that people who are coming from the East are not eligible for refugee status in Turkey at all. Their cases are handled by the UN High Commissioner for Refugees, which is then required to move them out of the country as quickly as possible.
I lost that train of thought for just a second. You said if they come from the East, they cannot get refugee status directly from Turkey. They have to get it from the UN High Commission on Refugees.
That's right.
So why is that? I mean, so if you're saying if they had come to Turkey from some other continent, they would be okay somehow.
Only Europeans are eligible to be refugees in Turkey. So if you happen to be a German who's escaping persecution in Berlin and come to Turkey for protection, you might be eligible for protection. But if you're Iranian, you can't get asylum in Turkey at
or
all.
Or South African, or how about a U.S. citizen?
No, also not.
Okay.
Also not. So, but Turkey does tolerate, and this is to Turkey's credit, Turkey does tolerate refugees living on its soil while the UNHCR adjudicates their cases and moves them on to other places. So Turkey is relatively safer, but what most of the clients that we speak to tell us is that the anti-gay violence on the street in Turkey is actually worse than it is in Iran. Because ironically, the Iranian people are, by and large, very tolerant people. There's gay bashing is almost unheard of. So the persecution that you'll see in Iran, for example, is almost exclusively at the hands of the authorities.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas in Turkey, the police typically won't persecute someone, but won't intervene when private individuals do it.
Right. Okay. So it's, sticky situation.
Mm-hmm.
You're tuned to Out in the Bay. I'm Eric Jansen. My guest is Neil Grundgrass, founder of the Organization for Refuge, Asylum, and Migration. We're talking about anti-gay violence in the Middle East and other parts of the globe and the plight of gay, lesbian, and transgender refugees fleeing their homelands. Neil, I want to ask, what's the percentage of people who make it, you know, eventually to a country where they actually are safe or feel safe? You know, because you're saying so many go from, for example, from Iran or Afghanistan to Turkey, and they don't have any possessions anymore because they've left them all behind, and they face anti-gay harassment, not at the hands of the government, but now at the hands of private citizens. How many of them make it out of there to someplace safe?
Estimates are that there are 10 million refugees in the world in total. A little over 100,000 are resettled every year. That's 1%.
Mm-hmm.
So the chances that you'll be resettled at all if you're a refugee to somewhere safe is minuscule. In the situation of Turkey, it's a bit better. The chances are about 20% that if you're a refugee, you'll be able to be resettled out of Turkey to somewhere safe. When you ask about LGBTs, I can't give you a real answer because no one has counted. We're doing the first survey ever that's ever been conducted on the subject that was actually funded by the Arcus Foundation to study NGO attitudes toward LGBT refugees to see where they're going, where they're coming from, where they're going, and what attitudes are they coming across when they're arriving in the country's first asylum so that we can start to get a handle on the situation.
And you're just embarking on that study, or do you have any data yet?
We're just embarking on the study right now. We have data that is pretty disturbing. The data is anecdotal. It's not empirical, but it seems that most of the organizations that are supposed to be helping refugees on the ground in various countries are as hostile or almost as hostile to LGBTs as anyone else in the population.
Because they're part of that culture as well.
Exactly.
Sure.
Exactly.
Now, what about, you mentioned Amnesty International a couple minutes ago. It seems, I hope I'm not bad-mouthing them, it seemed like it took them a while to get on the bandwagon to realize that sexual orientation was one of the reasons that people were jailed, for example, and that's they finally started helping people who were imprisoned for that reason. Do you find, as among the major international humanitarian aid organizations, is homosexuality just not on their radar at all?
It's becoming more on the radar. It's of course now on the radar for Human Rights Watch, which has a very active LGBT department. It's now on the radar for human Amnesty International. It's on the radar for several groups now, but nowhere near where it should be, considering the magnitude of the problem, considering the depth of the problem, and considering the severity of the persecution worldwide. It was also not on the radar for the UN High Commissioner for Refugees, which is one of the reasons that we started to do advocacy there. So this is the UN agency that's responsible for most of the refugees in the world and had issued its first paper on LGBT refugees in November of last year.
Okay.
Before that, had not even mentioned the issue.
One last thing I want to ask you, because we're actually, believe it or not, the half hour has flown by. We're almost out of time. You on your website, there's information about a new program you're starting called Refugee Community Empowerment. Mm-hmm. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
We're taking active steps to have each of our clients help other clients take action, whether it's helping another client fill out paperwork, whether it's explaining the process to another refugee, whether it's talking to people somewhere else in the world, explaining to them what the situation is. We want to get away from a situation of a helpless refugee and a powerful Western NGO, you know, taking them out by the hand. We want to empower our clients to understand what they've undergone, to feel more self-respecting by virtue of what they're doing, and to feel that there's a value to their lives by actually doing something for somebody else. I do not believe that we're ever going to be able to solve this problem by coming in as a foreign organization and doing our work. We need to teach LGBTs everywhere that they have a right and that they have a value, and that if they're not protected, that they can seek protection somewhere else.
Now, your organization is pretty young. You just started in 2008, is that right?
That's right.
So, you know, can you say about the progress you've made so far? You know, I know it's in its infancy, really, but it seems like you're having an impact already.
I think so, and it's actually extraordinary. Our main goal is actually to mainstream the issue of LGBT refugees. We don't want to be the LGBT refugee agency. Mm-hmm. We want everyone else to assist LGBT refugees just like they assist political refugees, religious refugees, whatever. And in that sphere, I think we're already having an impact. Many of the people we're talking to are saying, wow, I'd never thought about this. You're right. Why hasn't anyone talked about it? I see clients coming through my office, but no one's talking about a pattern. No one's showing me the numbers. We did last year a panel for the first time ever, a panel discussion at the UN High Commission for Refugees in Geneva on this. And there were hundreds of people who came up to us after the panel and said, congratulations, this is amazing. It's time. It's time people started to talk about this issue. It's time to bring this out of the closet.
Thank you very much. I want to thank Neil Grundras, founder of the Organization for Refuge, Asylum, and Migration, for taking time to talk with us about anti-gay atrocities in the Middle East and other parts of the globe, and how his organization is helping refugees who have fled their homelands. You can learn more about ORAM's work at ORAM's website, oraminternational.org. That's oraminternational.org. You've been listening to Out in the Bay, a weekly show about gay life in San Francisco and beyond. Out in the Bay is different from other public radio shows. We're an independently produced gay-themed program for gay and straight listeners. When we interview Ang Lee or John Waters or Sybil Shepherd or Judy Shepherd, Matthew's mother, my co-producer Marilyn Pittman and I are able to ask questions that un-gay radio shows and hosts can't or don't. And we cover subjects that the mainstream media barely touches, like the murder of gays in Baghdad, transgender and even intersex issues and queer politics. We've been producing Out in the Bay for 5 years now, and to continue, we'd like your support. It's easy and tax deductible. Just go to our website, outinthebay.com, and click on the donate button. Out in the Bay is broadcast on KALW.org and 91.7 FM Thursdays at 7 p.m. Pacific Time. You can hear us whenever you want on our website, outinthebay.com, where we have 8 months worth of archive shows, and you can also sign up there for free weekly podcasts. Out in the Bay is independently produced by Marilyn Pittman and me. We thank KALW for studio time. Thanks also to WY Enterprises for maintaining our website. WY Enterprises, helping you manage your life and your business. We'd love to hear from you. Please write to us, Marilyn at outinthebay.com or Eric at outinthebay.com. I'm Eric Jansen. Thanks for listening.